Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're pleased to have with us Helen MacDonald, author of Schaller's Fish and H's for Hawk. Schaller's Fish was re-released in hardback in February, and H's for Hawk is finally in paperback, released in March, and now that it's in paperback, both by Grove Atlantic. Book clubs all over the world will rejoice, because book clubs like paperback books. Helen is a writer, poet, illustrator, and naturalist, and an affiliated research scholar at the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge. As noted, she's the author of H's for Hawk, as well as a cultural history of falcons titled, appropriately enough, Falcon, and three collections of poetry, one of which we'll be discussing today. Helen was a research fellow at Jesus College, Cambridge, has worked as a professional falconer, and has assisted with the management of raptor research and conservation projects across Eurasia. She writes for the New York Times. H's for Hawk has won every award there is, so I'm not going to list them all. One is the New York Times 10 Best Books of the Year, and it has obviously been a bestseller, especially at our bookstore where it flies off the shelves. That was a little pun. And it has obviously, like I said, been a bestseller since it was released in hardback in 2014. Oh, yeah, it's won the Samuel Johnson Prize and the Costa Book of the Year. That's enough awards. As the Schaller's Fish, suffice it to say, it combines my favorite things in verse: language, science, and literature, war, history, art, myth, and philosophy. And as to that book, my usual listeners are asked in advance to forgive my one convoluted metaphor per show. This volume is hissing lead shot through water. You know where it, like lightning... Oops, that turned it into a simile. Never mind. Came from, so you know where it came from and approximately where it might end. The middle, the essence, is wrapped in bubbles of air and liquid, sometimes lost in speed, but also absorbed by the eye and ear in an ineluctable way, as if through an additional sense that one may or may not have. How's that for convoluted? Okay, on to H's for Hawk, a father's death, a grief unresolved, the longing for closure but finding none, and then a link between loss and redemption through the auspices of a goshawk, its training, the fear and longing of its fate tied inextricably with the author, and then resolution, if not answer. And to top things off, a vivid and intense study of T.H. White, one of my favorite authors who I always envisioned in a kind of Santa Claus way, which is now completely destroyed thanks to the author. And with that, certainly more than enough. Welcome, Helen, and thanks so much for being with us here today.
Hello. It's really great to be here. I'm slightly nervous of saying anything now. That was the most extraordinary introduction. I feel I can't possibly live up to it. Thank you very much. It's really nice to be talking to you.
You just have to watch that I don't keep doing this so you don't sell books and don't get a chance to say anything, just because I can blather. On a more somber note, your dad died in 2007, I think.
Yeah.
And that was 10 years after, am I pronouncing Schaller's correct?
Schaller's Fish, yeah.
That's 10 years after the publication, 1997, of that book, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what did he think? I always wondered.
The book?
Yeah.
That's a great question. You know, my dad grew up in the East End of London to a working class family. I think he had one O-level, which was the exam then. One O-level, I think, in woodwork. you know, he wasn't a great literary reader. He was a very fine photographer and was really obsessed with non-fiction books and had this huge library in our house, you know, and my mother used to tear her hair out at all these books that would be smuggled in, you know. So, yeah, lots of books on things, but I think he found the poetry absolutely incomprehensible, which, you know, and he thought that was great. He really enjoyed the fact he didn't understand a word of it, and we used to laugh about it. So, yeah, I miss him still. He was a great, great man.
I know. My dad died 22 years ago, and I still think about him every day.
Yeah, they don't ever disappear. And
no.
One of the things that you know, people sometimes say to me is, you know, that you know, people have told them to get over that you get over grief, and I think it's really important that you don't get over grief. You just become the kind of person that can hold that grief within you, you know, and respect and love the person that's gone. I feel really strongly that getting over thing is a terrible idea.
You know, yeah, and my brother and I argue about this because as much as he loved my dad, he says that I mythologize him, and I say, well, if you're going to mythologize anyone, you know, and
yeah. Absolutely. Parents are there to be mythologizing all sorts of ways, good and bad. That's what they're for, yeah.
Well, so we'll talk about each book, but Because I think the re-release is really obviously for you and the publisher very well timed and it's working well at our bookshop as well. No. So the epigraph, and I love epigraphs because I think the author is trying to tell you, okay, this book is going to be about this.
Yeah.
So the epigraph in Shallow's Fish is, when I sat me down before my tin pan, Agassiz brought me a small fish, placing it before me with a rather stern requirement that I should study it, but should on no account talk to anyone concerning it, nor read anything related to fishes, until I had his permission so to do. And what was really funny is, when I read that, I thought of Merlin turning wart into a perch.
Yeah.
But that's the other book.
It is the other book. It's quite scary how it's, you know, sort of, those themes reappear and reappear and reappear, don't they? I mean, they do it. You do it without even knowing that that's happening. So that quote is a lovely one, and I first encountered it in Ezra Pound's ABC of Reading way back when. And it's about the importance of looking, of observation, of seeing what Ruskin would have said, you know, the importance of seeing. And I mean, the story is great, you know. This chap, Shaler, goes, you know, he starts to write about this fish, and but he's not looking at it. He's not paying attention to what's in front of him. He's just writing about things he's heard about or read about fish. Agassiz sort of says, no, this is not how we should work. You just keep looking at that fish until you can say something, you know, important about it. And I guess that's kind of what the poems are about. They're about responses to a natural world and our place in it and sort of complicated other things. And it's kind of a bit of a joke in other ways because I didn't want the poems to be very, you know, they're quite hard. I mean, they're a lot of fun with difficulty with these poems.
Yeah, they are hard.
Look at them closely to sort of see what's going on. And even then, they kind of resist what, you know, attempts at kind of unpacking them. And I had a lot of fun doing that. Yeah, it was fun to write them.
Well, the thing that I thought was funny was because the poems deal in good measure with birds. The book deals solely with birds, and your epigraph deals with a fish.
Yeah. There are poems about other things too. I mean, honestly, I mean, the listeners are sort of like, oh, it's a bird book.
There's birds in
about,
there.
There's a poem about the invention of the F-111, you know, kind of aircraft. So there's more than birds in there, but there's a lot of birds in there, and I think that's what I've always been familiar with.
Well, yeah, but that, you combine aircraft and birds and hawk quite well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you've got me there. Actually, I throw my hands up in the air. Yeah, no, totally.
All right. Well, if you take like a poem like Parallax Nonpareil, what you do there is all of a sudden you're reading this book about Newtonian physics, but then it kind of goes into quantum physics.
Yeah.
You know, with a 10 space.
Yeah.
And string theory. And then somehow you link it to integrity, kindness, and love. And I know it's neither fashionable or helpful generally to decipher poetry like a Rosetta Stone. But when I read it, yeah, I said, I get it. But then, you know, it's really, just like any good poet, it's really hard to say to somebody else, here's what it's about.
Yeah.
Because it's not.
Yeah, a very eminent poet I once had a conversation with. We had a furious argument. I'm not going to mention him by name because it would be incredibly impolite of me. But he said that in his classes, he always says to people if they bring him a poem, you know, what does it mean? And if they can't tell him what it means in 10 seconds, he says, well, you know, go away and write a different poem. And I became furious with him. You know, I think, you know, life's more complicated than that. One of the things I was doing with this particular collection was that I became really fascinated with the kind of cadences of high English lyric, particularly romantic lyric poetry. And, you know, back then, you know, it was full of science. It was full of all sorts of, you know, aspects of life that we don't tend to kind of think about as being poetic. And it was politically engaged, and it was kind of hard, and it was kind of... So I thought, you know, I'm going to take the lyric poem, and I'm going to stuff it full of all sorts of specialized taxonomies and kind of linguistic stuff and linguistic rubble and be really playful and get stuff into poems that's not supposed to be there. And that in itself... You know, sometimes writing them, I felt like a bit like I was pretending to be an abstract expressionist. You know, I was kind of just throwing paint around. But the things that I wanted to say are always kind of underneath the surface about, you know, how we think about the world, really, how we carve nature at the joint.
Well, it's what you do. It's several spots in the book, in Hawk, And here, too, is you take nature and you create this amalgam, and amalgam is good because you talk about amalgam when you're talking about, like, lead, like my lead shot, or pewter going through the bones, the airy bones of a hawk. And what you do in the first few pages of Hawk is you're walking along this man-created scene, and you try to, you know, you don't try to, you do conjoin what man has wrought or unwrought along with this creature that almost becomes metal-like. And then you do the same thing when she looks up and sees the flying fortress, you know, and just gives it a little glance, you know.
Yeah.
And you constantly combine those two, and it's really, it's, what's the word? You tell me the word. Why are you drawn to this combination between these artifacts that we create and the natural world?
Well, I think perhaps the deepest theme of the book, I mean, apart from, you know, the old life and death one, is about, you know, how we see the natural world, and how, you know, it's very much impossible for us to see any natural objects, any natural landscapes, without bringing our own concerns and needs to bear on them. And the big lesson of the book is that I saw the hawk as everything I wanted to be. She was this solitary, self-possessed creature that I used as a mirror of my own grief. I saw her as me. And the big revelation at the end of the book is that she's not, you know, she's a bird, for goodness sake, you know. And realizing that everything I saw her to be was my own human construction, constrained by, you know, my own cultural moment and my own history and things I'd read and felt and seen, was the big thing, you know, that this we should appreciate and love the natural world because it's not us, you know. And I think that same movement, you know, the meanings we give things, is equally applicable to all sorts of objects, you know, airplanes, obviously, you know, which share many of the same symbolic attributions of as hawks.
So that
sense of you know, looking at metals and man-made objects and seeing them in the same frame as we see the natural world is really important as a subject for me.
I think the most evanescent one is when you're talking about Auden's poetry and you have a hawk and a U-2 pilot and you compare the two and what they're seeing.
Yeah.
And it's like when you're talking about falconry and you talk about how it's lasted for ages, and you as the falconer are doing exactly the same thing that somebody, and it's when I sit by my pond, sit there thinking or eating an apple or whatever, I know my pond's been there for hundreds of years, and I know that somebody else was sitting there doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of...
And that's a really interesting moment when you have that kind of virtual time traveling that I talk about quite a bit in the book, that sense that the years drop away when you're doing these familiar things, and you can imagine someone else doing them before you, you know, right back in history, and how that's both really grounding and a really sobering, and gives you a lot of humility to think you're only here for a brief time and others have done what you have done.
I know.
But I also talk about it being politically really interesting too. You know, one of the big problems in Britain now is there's a lot of worry about immigration and, you know, who does England belong to? And I talk a lot in the book, and it's a very important subject for me, is that sense of that we try and legitimate our claim on places through an appeal to history and appeal to people like us having been in this place before, and othering other people who come in. And I just think that's another subject that, you know, I have to write another book at some point, and I think that's going to have to be really the heart of it.
I have enough post-apocalyptic books in my bookstore. Don't write another one. But it's like, you do talk about, you know, you dream, or when you're going crazy, which you say you are, I'm not saying it, but you know, you dream of, you think of, this is the end of everything, you know, these things are all going to end.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because, well, another one, when I sit by my fireplace, which is this gigantic fireplace, and I sit in front of it, it's not only that you feel grounded, you feel the weight of these past generations upon you.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, it's Merlin-esque, it's almost magical.
It is, and I'm thinking you live in a very nice house.
1775.
Lovely stuff. I that sort of sense of time, again, really important to me in both the poetry and the book, and sort of temporal imaginings are caught up in the poems as well, and I play with tense quite a lot and all sorts of things there.
That's true.
But I think this notion of apocalypse was certainly, you know, weighed on me when I was a child, and, you know, I talk in the book about that expectation that we'd all end up, you know, fried in a nuclear war. And I think growing up in the 1970s and 80s, you know, it's left a particular kind of charge about the possibility of everything ending at once.
Yeah, we
something like an accident. And T.H. White was very concerned with that notion of war as well, and he quite often, as he was training his hawk late at night, would be sitting by his own fire in his tiny kitchen with his taper and his oilskin tablecloth and his oil lamp and musing on history and how time had brought him to this space and how the war had affected everything. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of importance about kind of just thinking very quietly about those things as you go through life, I think.
Well, it's funny because going to White, when Sylvia Warner goes to his house because she's going to be his biographer, and she goes to, as you describe, his sewing basket, and she rummages through it, and she says she's never felt such an imminent haunt.
Yeah.
You know, Goss, he's lost, flagellation, homosexuality, despair, yeah, self-hatred. And then you have this kind of following you, and I don't even know, I can't, if you said to me, define imminent haunt, I can't. So you define it.
Well, I mean, the phrase I think that maybe captures it the best for me was when I went to the University of Texas in Austin, went to the Harry Ransom Center there and was reading through all of his unpublished works and diaries and journals, and I began to feel that he was standing right behind me, reading over my shoulder. You know, it was right there. He was right there, haunting me. And I think part of the reason those books were so extraordinarily moving was that partly he's a very candid writer, and partly they're full of stuff. They're full of photographs and feathers. These, you know, as you were saying earlier, the idea that history can be contained in things. And I certainly, you know, you sort of look down and you see, you know, the claw of a lark that one of his hawks has caught, and he's stuck it to the page, and it's still there. And you can see tear spots where he's been crying on the pages. So, yeah, he really did haunt me. Not so much now, but I think that, you know, I have never written fiction, but there was something about writing White's part of the book which was very like that. I had to try and get inside his head as much as I could to be the person who was writing those sections. And the book is about that need or the desire to escape from yourself and look through other eyes. And one pair of eyes in the book are the eyes of the hawk, and the other pair are his. And recently I had the great, great honor of actually visiting the house, actually going inside the house that he was living in at the time when he trained the hawk, and which later became Merlin's cottage. And, I got dizzy. I mean, it really hasn't changed very much since the 1930s. And I felt I'd been there before. It was astonishing thing to do.
But you can understand how I, growing up, you know, reading The Once and Future King, A Sword in the Stone, and seeing the Disney movie, how irritated I got at you for turning this.
I'm so sorry. He was an astonishing man. You know,
he was miserable.
He was, and, you know, he became a man who had great success later in life. You know, he was doing kind of tours of America and wandering around in opera cloaks and hats and being very cool. But I don't think he was ever happy. There's a story that I always makes my heart hurt a little bit when I read about later in his life. He was very good friends with Julie Andrews and her husband, which seems very strange if you've read The Goshawk. And one Christmas, he spent with them, and Julie Andrews and her husband gave him a Christmas stocking full of wrapped little presents like toy trains. And he said, "What is it?" And they said, "It's a Christmas stocking, Tim." And he was opening the presents and looking at these little gifts, and after every single gift, he'd have to leave the room and cry, because no one had ever given him a Christmas stocking before. And I think, you know, that deep poignancy of a man who hadn't been given any of the tools to know how to look after things or love things, including himself, is a story that's much bigger than White. You know, and I love that man. You know, he was a nightmare in many ways. But, you know, I'm really glad I got to know him as I wrote the book. And I feel, yeah, he was a really, really extraordinary writer. And, I don't think you should be too hard on him. I think he's a worthy person, despite all his flaws.
Well, he overcame. I mean, sometimes you talk about nature and nurture. It wasn't his nature. It wasn't his genetics. He just had this horrible, horrible upbringing.
Yeah. I kind of assume he was always gay, but I think a lot of his other kind of issues, that he had some real problems with making connections with people, and he had this very violent childhood, and he was beaten at school. I mean, he really, really had a rough time, and I think that leaves terrible marks, yeah.
Well, You know, if you talk about genetics, it's interesting because one section of the book, when you talk about goshawks being nervous because the neurons between the eyes and I guess their mind, their brain, are numerous, but they lack a certain number of neurons connecting all this together, and they live their lives 10 times faster than we do. Mm. So that's why they're so high-strung and nervous. But I was wondering, because as that was happening in the book, you too were very nervous. You were anxious. You were constantly on edge.
So I was in pieces.
Well, you got enough neurons. So why?
I think maybe to answer that question in a sort of slightly more general manner, I think one of the things that is really interesting about the way that people interact with animals is quite often they use us to speak for us, to say things that we can't otherwise say, or to be different versions of ourselves. I had a wonderful conversation recently with an eminent psychoanalyst. I hasten to say, not in a professional capacity, it was a social discussion. And he said he had a client who brings a dog to the session, and the client will sit there. The client has great problems expressing themselves, particularly anything emotional. But every so often, he'll say something, and there'll be a pause, and the client will say, "My dog's very angry with you." You know, it's a wonderful story. And everyone knows what's going on, really, here, apart from the dog, who just sits there and has treats, you know. And I think the hawk was a little bit like that. You know, I knew that goshawks were nervous birds. They you know, they're very frightened of people. And part of the reason that the goshawk was a great distraction to train was that it required enormous amounts of time and energy and patience and particular kinds of mental states, of quite, you know, sort of deep meditative states, to impress upon the hawk that I wasn't a monster. But at that time also, I wanted to impress upon myself that I wasn't a monster, and I wanted to be calm, and I wanted to be sort of, you know, tamed again. So there's all sorts of really deep transferences going on when you train a hawk. Quite inevitably, when anyone trains a hawk, this happens. But when you're broken and you're grieving and you don't want to be yourself anymore, you know, it can be quite dangerous. And I think I really did take it too far. You know, I wanted to be this bird. I wanted to be this absolutely self-possessed, fierce thing that lived in the present, you know, and that didn't have a memory and didn't have human concerns. And I did pretty well with that, actually, but it nearly broke me. Yeah.
Well, there's two things that reminds me of. Is one, the guy who was holding the terrified bird, and you recognizing that the love that you felt for him is the same love you felt for your father.
Yeah.
I do that all the time. I do that all the time. And the other one is His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, which I loved.
Yeah.
And you talk about that, which I thought was interesting that you brought that in, and about, you know, the fact that each person has its own animal, kind of like in Harry Potter or kind of like an avatar. And that animal, when it's separated from its master, owner, friend, the person becomes somewhat of a shell of himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of wonderful concretization of the idea of a human soul, and everyone has a different animal that represents who they are. And if you read those books, I mean, it's an incredibly compelling conceit, and a really old one, really. Yeah, I mean, the hawk was my demon, and you know, I talk in the book about attachment theory, and, you know, I've read all that stuff, and I talk about a really amazing and very disturbing paper by the Winnicott about a small boy who used to tie things together with string, including, you know, chairs and tables, and at one point the neck of his sister, which was obviously, you know, raised alarm bells. And it turned out that he was trying to join things. He was trying to join things because he was worried his mother would disappear. She was quite often depressed. And I think the falconry side of it certainly ties up with that, this sense that I was testing attachments with that bird. I was testing every time it flew away that it would come back. And when the bird becomes who you are in your imagination, then every time the bird flies, if it comes back, it's a kind of a reinscription that you're still around and you're still in the world. I mean, it's deeply weird. I've just suddenly remembered, actually, years ago, talking to my father about the Philip Pullman book, and we were laughing about what demons we'd be. You know, if we had demons, what would they be? And he kind of looked around, and he screwed his eyes up, and he thought for a bit, and he said, "I think I'd be an albatross." And I said, "Why would you be an albatross, Dad?" And he kind of grinned and said, I just fly around the world's oceans laughing at dolphins. I was just really like, Which, you know, I think, again, that flight thing was very, you know, that notion of flight and transcendence and very much part of it.
It reminds me of the Monty Python skit, Albatross.
Yeah, Albatross.
But, you know, it's funny, when I was singing a poem, and I was just realizing, because you talk a little bit about Lucifer and a fallen angel, and I realize in the Pullman book, I kind of liked Lucifer better than a lot of the other characters because.
Well, I mean, the same in Milton. I mean, he's really cool.
Yeah.
I remember reading Paradise Lost when I was quite young and going, God, this guy's amazing. As a character, he's much more interesting and complicated and viable on the page than the others.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Jesus decided, albeit against probably a lot of his longing, to become divine. And Lucifer was, I guess, against his will, forced to become what? Human?
Yeah.
You know, it's a very strange concept.
It is. And that Lucifer scene in the book. Sorry, I've got a very creaky chair, I've just realized. I'll try to stop moving.
No, it's good.
Creaky English chair. There's a book by T.H. White, it was never published, which has this very strange meeting at the end of it where he meets a man who's clearly himself in his imagination, this happy man who's fulfilled and has a great life. He's wandering around in the dark with dogs. Who's actually Lucifer? Who is the devil? And I think it's one of the reasons that book never really made the light of day was that it was incredibly emotionally exposing. But also, he just stole the ending from Sylvia Townsend Warner. I mean, it's pretty much the same as Lolly Willows, which if people haven't read, they should get out and read instantly. But this sense, I think, of transgression, of staking your claim to Lucifer, who's conceived of as a character who attracts outcasts, attracts others, and obviously both White and Townsend Warner were gay and struggling with that. I think Townsend Warner at that point possibly hadn't reconciled herself to that. I think that's really interesting as a kind of, you know, Lucifer is an anti-hero for the people who feel they're outcasts. And I didn't really get into it in the book, but it's a really interesting area to think about, yeah.
The other thing that was fascinating, I don't even know if it's in the book, maybe it was in an interview I read, and you contrast against a lot of what's in the book is that your father lived this life in which he strove to make things not disappear. Mm-hmm. You know, even from the beginning when he was taking pictures with the brownie of the planes and noting their tail numbers, until, as you said in that interview, he waited 12 hours to get the picture that is in everyone's mind when they think of Charles and Diana. It's a lot of work. It was a lot of work.
My mum was so cross with him at that point. He came back. He'd been standing in the same place outside Buckingham Palace to get this one photo of Princess Diana and Prince Charles kissing, and he got it. And he hadn't eaten or drunk, you know, for the 12 hours, and he came back, and he pretty much collapsed, and she was like, what are you doing? And he just kept saying, I got the picture, you know. So, yeah, that sense that there are moments in time which, you know, once, it's like Blake, really, you know, that once you get those moments, then, you know, that's your triumph.
And also,
sorry, I butted in there very rudely. Do go on.
No, and I was going to say, and also when your father saw the sky and it was doing this thing that you're only going to see once in a lifetime, and he tries to tell the little boy to look, and the little boy doesn't. Mm. And then you, at the end of the book, see the sky filled with these question marks of spiders going up and going down. You take the time. You're there because of your father observing it. And it reminds me of... do you know what the green flash is?
I do, and I tried to see it many times, but you know what? Not yet. It's going to happen.
I saw it once. I was with my ex-wife, and I saw it, and I didn't believe it, so I turned to her, and I said, did you? And she goes, yes. And it was amazing. It was like your poetry. It's exactly like my metaphor.
My poetry is like the green flash. Wow, I'm honored.
That's a good, that is actually good.
I'm a bit of an eclipse chaser, actually. I've been to see the total eclipses a few times, and those experiences, if anyone has ever got the opportunity to see a total eclipse, then, you know, you should run and fly and, you know, beg to get to see one, because, you know, when the sun slides away and there's a hole in the sky, you know, surrounded by darkness, I mean, the first time I saw that, my legs gave way. I just sat on the ground. I couldn't breathe.
And that's why prehistoric man must have thought.
Exactly. And then when suddenly, you know, all the birds stop singing and there is this really strange twilight and it really is like a pressure on your chest. You can hardly, you know, cope with what's happening. And then the sun reappears and the world is illuminated again. And, you know, pretty much everyone around me in all these experiences, everyone just bursts into tears. I mean, these events, these sort of celestial events, they really plug into some very deep stuff, yeah. I'm just laughing about all those old books about total eclipses, and it's always some terrible kind of imperial you know, colonial kind of, you know, Orientalist thing where, you know, someone's about to get murdered and they say, oh, I'm going to make the, tell the gods to make the sun go out. You know, I'm just cringing thinking about it.
It's, yeah, if you don't know what's happening, it is the end of the world. You know, there's a method to my madness in interviews, and so I kind of lead from one thing to another, and that just led me to think about, and this is, I think this is because you're a poet. Why are you compelled, probably, yeah, as I say, to as a poet, to describe your bird so vividly in terms of color and texture when you say, a shower of falling raindrops, wings the color of stained oak, their covert feathers stained in teak, silvery light like a rainy sky reflected from the surface of a river. And then what I said earlier, pewter had been poured into her long and airy bones. What do you want us, the reader, to see and to feel when you do that? Because it's so incredibly visual.
Yeah, yeah, egg frosts. I want the reader to have that, well, I hope the reader have that sort of...
It's like you're waiting for the reader to reach a threshold.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I grew up wanting to be an artist a lot of the time, and I spent most of my young life painting. And still now, when I look at any scene, I realized quite recently that when I look at a landscape or a scene, I'm generally blocking out color values in my head. So visual stuff is very important to me. And to try and capture particular colors and particular qualities of light is something I find really interesting when I'm writing. And because they're the things that tend to spark us, I think, more than just saying there's a green tree or there's a hill. You know, the fact that the light on the hill is sort of slightly grainy, there's a lot of maybe wheat dust in the air, or, you know, if there's fog coming in. Those moments where the light changes on the landscape as time passes tend to be the moments which suck you into an actual time and place. So, yeah, I tried to do that with the bird. And you know, she trying to sort of capture my own states of mind at the time through looking at color and visual stuff is part of it. But again, as I said early on in the interview about...
Well, it's like, poetry, you know, you really are like your dad. I mean, you just take the photograph in words. I mean, that paragraph is a photograph and you got it. That's the whole idea.
It's nice that you said that. Thank you. I'm honored.
Well, don't you think it's a compliment, I guess. I didn't mean it to be a compliment, but it's true, though. I mean, that paragraph, which I don't usually go back and read a paragraph twice, but... Yeah, after you read it, you realize, okay, she's taken this color. She's taken, how, you know, what is rain reflected against? What is water reflected against water? And, you know, it is something, and I've seen it, but it's usually only in the image and not in the...
That was actually quite a hard paragraph to write that. Most of the stuff about the hawk I wrote really fast. It was kind of automatic. It just sort of poured onto the page. But trying to get down what she was like, trying to describe her actually physically was very hard. And I remember at one point I became obsessed with remembering that there was in the British Museum, there's an articulated model snake from, I don't remember what dynasty in China, but it's this beautiful object made of linked bits of iron, hammered iron. And I became absolutely consumed with the idea that everything about the pork could be explained through discussing this snake. So I wrote about this snake for about two pages where I was like, no, come on, Helen. Come on, that's a bit of an ask. You know, why don't you just describe what color she was?
At first I thought that too, and then I realized, no, this is really, really good. At first I was going, okay, I get it. It's a hawk, all right, you know?
Yeah,
and then I realized, no, this is what makes this. It's, but then, you know, like, then you threw in this, every once in a while you threw in something and I said, I wonder what she's doing now. Like when you threw in the words Abu Ghraib, and I'm thinking, okay, I know how I feel about that. I know the picture. I know exactly what it looked like. I know exactly how hellish it was.
Yeah.
And you threw it in there, though, and I'm wondering, wait, how come? Why did she?
Why there?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't use that picture or that reference lightly. I've maybe explained to listeners if they haven't read the book, this is the point where when hawks are very nervous, falconers hood them. They put a little kind of leather hood on their head. It's very light, it just blocks out the light, and it's where the word hoodwink comes from. And quite reasonably, once the hawk gets a bit tamer, it starts to see this as a bit of an intrusion upon its desire to see the world. You know, eventually, the hawk just thinks, okay, I'll put the hood on and I'll take it off and I'll eat, and they become very chilled out about it. They go to sleep when it's on. And I suddenly realized the ramifications of taking this bird's sight away to calm it. And I was in a very bad state psychologically at that point. I was missing my father a lot. I was kind of broken, and I started to think about what it meant to take something sideways to calm it, and I started to think about all sorts of otherhoods, and suddenly that image was in my mind, and I had to put it down. You know, one of the ways that this book, I hope, works is that, you know, everything that happens in it is really tracking what actually happened, the thought processes that I had at the time. And a lot of those thought processes are really messed up. You know, I mean, it was a long time before I got around to writing the book, but, you know, the person I was when all this happened, I could remember pretty much everything with this extraordinary clarity, and I think that's to do with grief. It does things to the workings of memory. And quite often as I was writing, I'd end up kind of throwing pens across the room. You know, I was so cross with this person I'd been. But that's where it ended up. That was that awful photograph. And, you know, and later on in the book as well, there's a much, much later on when I really am in dire straits.
Yeah, it's obviously funny when you realize.
Not the band. yeah, I start to think about waterboarding as well.
And you described that as well. And now here in America, I'm not even going to get to what's going on in America now. Let's not even do that.
Let's not talk about
that
right now, no.
But, you know, it's funny because you talk about these things, and it brings to mind, well, in the beginning, when you said, when I started this 7 years ago, and so then I couldn't tell what the time frame was for a while, and then I realized your father died in 2007.
Yeah, 20th of March, actually, very soon. It's coming up to our anniversary, which is always a bit hard. But yeah,
my
father, long time ago now.
And my father's is April 15th, 1994. But when you do that, if you started at 7 years before 2014 when it was published, or actually more than that, you must have started it right at the moment you were still assimilating.
Well, no, I didn't. I knew there was a story to tell. I knew there was a big story that had happened towards the end of that year. Oh, sorry, drinking tea here, I'm hiccuping. I knew there was a story that was... it had a kind of mythical structure to it. It was about, you know, letting go, having a rite of passage, going into the underworld, coming back. You know, it was a going away and coming back story. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, you don't realize these stories are happening to you until they've happened. But I didn't think it was going to be a book until much later. And it wasn't until about 5 years after it happened that I realized that I could write about it, and I needed that distance. So the book itself took me about a year and a half to write, but I did it full time.
Okay.
You know, and obviously, you know, some days, you know, I'd write 2,000 words and I'd dance around thinking I was the greatest thing ever. And then other days, I'd sit there and get 2 words out and cry for an hour. I mean, it's not an even thing to do to write a book, as everyone knows once they've done it. But so yeah, it was weird. And the bits, as I said earlier, I mean, the bits about that were concerned with a hawk were much easier to write about than the expository bits about my father's death and how that, you know, played out. And then trying to weave in the T.H. White material, too. It was like doing a very complicated jigsaw quite a lot of the time.
Yes,
but really interesting. It was an interesting thing to do, really interesting challenge.
Yeah, and, you know, it does, that part, the T.H. White part, does, like, when Goss is up in the tree and, you know, he treats it so terribly, but I can almost see myself being the same way in a given situation. We all reach a point where...
Yeah, I think we all can.
We've
all unconsciously been thoughtless or not understood how to treat people or things, and I think that hopefully is part of why I wanted to write about it.
Well, what reminded me of it was you were talking about weaving these threads, and I was thinking of his hawk up in the tree with everything woven together, and, you know, what a mess, you know, like when you're fishing and the line gets so tangled, you know. Yeah, you can either be one person and spend a day untangling it, or you can be like me and taking a razor blade and just starting over.
Or you can be like White and drag the hawk down with the end of a fishing line and then shout at the hawk and say it's all your fault.
Oh, you know
what I mean? I
know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, the idea of sadism,
yeah,
it's just so strange because, and that's where I really got angry at you, but sorry. It was just because
I'm not going to try and control your emotional response to this book in any way. Fear not.
Well, that's the one thing an author has the luxury. I mean, but, you know, and I guess we can close with this because we've been talking for over 41 minutes. But what do you expect from your reader? I mean, this is not only a child of yours that you're letting out into the world, or that you did because now it's in paperback, but it's you that you're letting out into the world. And what do you expect? Everybody's read this book, and I know because I own a bookstore. And so here's you, naked, here. I'm giving you me.
Yeah.
What do you expect of the reader?
That's a really interesting question. I've quite often asked, you know, are you not horrified by the exposure? This is a really open book and honest book, you know, emotionally. And I get a bit bemused by that, partly because the person in it is not quite me anymore. She was, you know, this is me 10 years ago now. But partly because I just feel that when you've written a book or you've written a poem or you've done something, it's like you've made a pot or something on a potter's wheel. You know, you've made this thing out of all that you've known, all the skills you've tried to hone over the years. And once you've made it, it's not yours anymore. You know, you put it on the shelf or you sell it or you give it away. And people's responses to it are, you know, they're their responses. And I mean, having said that, I've been really deeply moved by the number of people who've come to me since the book has come out. Readers, you know, one of the great things I've been doing is touring the last 2 years, really meeting readers, and that's been astonishing. And saying the book helped them in some way, or was really meaningful for them, because everyone's been through dark times. And, you know, I had a woman once say to me that this is a book for anyone who's ever wanted to run away from difficult circumstances, and I kind of grinned and sort of said, well, that's pretty much everyone, isn't it? You know, and she said yes.
Yeah.
So, and some people like the book, some people hate it. You know, I really enjoy my Amazon one-star reviews. There's quite a few.
I love it.
One just goes, R is for rubbish, which I adore. And I just like, I love that you know, that it has such different reactions. I think it would be a very weird world if there weren't people who didn't like the book as well as love it. And, you know, the book is, in one way, it's a plea to love difference. So hooray for the readers that don't like it. But you know what? More hoorays for those who do. I'm very pleased they exist.
Well, it's funny because when you at the beginning kind of said you were nervous about the interview, I was nervous because you've already been on one tour, you're going on another tour, so I was thinking, I have to ask you stuff that hasn't never been asked before.
You have.
Good, I'm glad. So with that, yeah. I could sit there next to you with a rickety chair and a cup of tea and talk all day about this.
Another time, that would be great.
Another time could be tomorrow, because you don't want me coming down there, but you'll be at the Philadelphia Library tomorrow, which will be March 22nd at 7:30, and our library is a wonderful library, and they have wonderful events, and I hope everyone who's listening or listening to this on iTunes will come down tomorrow to the library, and I definitely will come down and see you there, and I thank you so much for being here today. It was wonderful.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was Helen MacDonald. She was talking both about Shaler's Fish, which is her book of poetry just re-released, and H is for Hawk, just released in paperback, both of which are wonderful books which are well worth reading. Reminder, Helen will speak at the Free Library of Philadelphia tomorrow, Tuesday, March 22nd at 7:30 p.m. I would be there. She's a wonderful speaker. She's got a great sense of humor, and I really enjoyed speaking with her in England about her two books, H is for Hawk and Shaler's Fish. If you join us every week on The Avid Reader, you'll get to hear lots of insightful and engaging discussions with today's most compelling authors. Upcoming authors include Lawrence Hill, who'll discuss his new book, The Illegal, poet Idra Novi, to discuss her debut novel, Ways to Disappear, and Peter Ross Range, to discuss the very, unfortunately, timely 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. So for a complete schedule, visit us at our website, wellingtonsquarebooks.com, or simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader.